Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour. This is for November 2nd, 2023, and some very interesting observations tonight. I'm going to be talking about this is an interesting thing that I talk a lot, not a lot, but occasionally about spirit, the spirit situation with the man, and how you can tell man is different from, say, your dog. Maybe your dog has some kind of spirit also, but the human spirit is very special. You recognize it in, say, music, where music can draw emotions, things like that. Whereas your dog does not get emotional when he hears, say, a song. And this starts from the time when people are little kids. Like, for example, I remember when I was a little kid, certain songs were I still remember them today, hearing them when I was a little kid, and being, somewhat, well, I don't know if I was emotional about them, but they affected me. They made me happy. They made me sad, or something like that. So this starts with, like, right away when people are little. But anyway, I wanted to talk about kind of a concept of God. And then, when I grew up, the kind of the implication, I don't know if it was really taught this way, is in the Christian belief or et cetera, was that God was kind of like peeking in on everybody. You could tell your thoughts, if you were good or bad. And the idea of conscience is very interesting. I may as well just do this discussion right now. Also, I'm going to be talking about some other issues, some interesting issues about the Apollo space program. Quite a few topics to cover tonight. But okay, back to this idea of conscience, where people who, like politicians, who are trying to scam everybody, they dress up in a suit and this double talk. We've seen politicians, there's this famous one where Barack Obama, and also Hillary Clinton, these two characters, where they're saying one thing to the public, and then you see them clips of them talking to one of these societies or groups of high level financier people, and they're saying something completely different about how their view of the public, in front of you for the election, they're, oh, we just were for you, the people, we're going to make everything better. And then to the closed elite groups, they're saying, yeah, those people over there, they're insignificant, and a whole different story. So absolute two-faced, bald-faced liars. And but the whole idea that they have to make this presentation to the public, this false image, is clear evidence of conscience. Because, any type of scammer has to lie. And you see this a lot in, like I say, in politics. And so the idea of conscience that is up very present, and what that means is that people have this sense of right or wrong, this kind of built in. Okay, so anyway, this idea of God peeking over your shoulder, and it's really something different. And you can go back to, say, Native American beliefs or other indigenous beliefs that man is part of the cosmic spirit, and that your body is part of this universal system, and that God has provided these things for your body to survive, but then also your spirit goes along with the body, and the thought processes, et cetera. For example, if you try to live an honest life, then if people come along and accuse you, falsely accusing people, then what they're trying to do is perform a guilt contract on you. And that's a technique that people use who are scammers, go through life scamming people. the spirit is connected with this universal kind of spirit, and truth and honesty is part of that. So anyway, the idea here is that God is not peeking in on you, but you are you're exposing your belief system, your thought system, and your activities to this consciousness, this kind of universal consciousness. And it's a whole different concept. I'm not sure if I'm explaining this well. So it is not as if God is peering into your life or peering or eavesdropping, so to speak, because you are part of the spirit, the universal spirit. And your spirit is not this individual entity all by itself. It's connected to the spirits of all people around you. And so when other diversions keep people from realizing this, spiritual chaos is the result. And that's what we have today, which leads into the second situation, this absolute insanity that's going on in the Mideast right now. And it's, of course, this is designed to disrupt, and it is. It's disrupting the United States. It's turning people one against the other who never, ever previously had differences. I just noticed where they closed classes at Cornell University, where I taught for 2 years. And having been there for 2 years, you know, and having been in the classroom with hundreds, if not thousands, of students, a large part, let's say, and these are statistics too, not just my observations, a large percentage of the student population at Cornell and faculty are Jewish. And it's a very high percentage. And of course, they claim diversity, etc. And they put up their poster child like any good college today has their diverse, showing all the different races, which is really racist by itself, that somehow because you have different skin colors there that you're diverse. So it's putting diversity on the color of skin, not on thought processes or anything else, which is extremely racist. But anyway, that's the way people present themselves today. But yeah, Cornell, apparently they're having a lot of problems with threats on students who are Jewish because of the attacks going on in the Mideast right now. Oh, my goodness. But also no call for, no serious calls for ceasefires. You know, there's lip service being presented, but nobody's really in there saying, shut this thing down. Okay, so I'm not going to get into that. There's a lot of people talking about that. And so I'm not going to spend my airtime discussing that. There's, that's being covered from all aspects on radio shows. So yeah, I'm not going to cover that anymore. Did I mention? I'll be on Jeff Rentz's show tonight as a guest, 9 o'clock Central Time, and discussing. Very interesting topic. I'll just quickly discuss this here. And it's something that I've been investigating because I'm able to look through lenses. Let's just put it that way. I spent 25 years in the telecommunications industry. And so it's something that I'm an expert in. I would say I'm in terms of people who qualify as expert status, I would definitely put myself in that category. I'm talking about digital telecommunications, or going even back to analog, because I grew up in the analog era and watched the digital era integrate. And so the protocols that they're using today for telecommunications are the same ones we developed back then in the early digital days. But anyway, this is something that's going on, and I don't think anybody's talking about this or realizing this. There was a big controversy about 5G coming in and damaging, etc., that would be used in conjunction with COVID shots. There were all of these arguments against 5G, and I'm not going to discuss that at all. What I'm going to discuss is that the telecommunications companies rolled out 5G, which is a short range compared to 4G. 4G was the previous technology, which is still there. And by the way, all of these companies have to continue supporting 4G, and in some cases, and in foreign countries, 3G. So all of this equipment is still out there being supported, and actually other protocols also, if you go into other foreign countries. But then all of a sudden, 5G comes along, and the capacity does not increase. They did not put in sufficient capacity when they rolled out 5G. And then all of a sudden, there are companies selling video services over the internet. So people are watching movies. And so, literally, 5G does not have the capacity to perform both in installed equipment base and in internet capacity. So anyway, the problem is, here's the situation, and I suggest you start looking at your phone a little closer. And this is something I discovered because I could look in from outside the US and look at the networking that's going on. It's a way of viewing things that someone like myself would know about. But anyway, a lot of times people are switching back to 4G and don't know it. So look on your phone, keep a track on, and up on the very top, it would say the type of service you're connected to. And you'll notice that 5G, a lot of times you're waiting. Say you're doing a search, you're on your telephone someplace, or you're doing some, say, GPS work or something like that, and it's delayed. And sometimes you don't notice a big delay, but it's somewhat of a delay. But then all of a sudden it switches back to 4G because the capacity is not there to support the 5G traffic. So you might have 5G, but one bar. And what that one bar means, it's supposed to mean that that is your the level of amplitude of the signal. But what it really means is it's the amount of capacity that's available for you. And you should have coverage. Now, this would be standard back in the 4G world. You would have 4G and 5 bars. That would be standard. And this would be T-Mobile was very poor with this around the country. Verizon was very good. And then you could go to the other, those are the big two. And then the other companies would fall in line. But back in the 4G world, you would have 4G with five bars. And now in today's world of 5G, a lot of times you'll have 5G with one or two bars, not five. And that's talking about the capacity that's available for you. So it's if you're down to one bar 5G, then you're very limited on capacity. The other thing is that the upload speeds for 5G are very, very poor. They have fixed the system so that the 5G download speed, everything's given to downloading. So, like you do something simple on a phone, or say you click on a movie to watch, and then it's purely downloading. And so, if you're somebody like that is doing uploading for whatever reason, it's going to be terribly slow because they simply don't give the capacity for uploading. The concept is with 5G is you do something simple and get this big download of information. So 5G really did not cover what 4G was already doing, is my point. And so 4G had fairly good upload speeds. 5G does not. And so the end result is that the companies, in their rush to install 5G, never built out the capacity. And they're feigning on that because now people are simply not aware of it. Excuse me. So it's something I'm going to talk in a lot more detail tonight on Jeff Rentz's show about that topic. So I'm just introducing it here. And then other topics. Here's something that came up, and it was spawned by my interest. I follow the space programs, but the Japanese and the Chinese are developing landing craft for the moon. And so what they're developing are three-legged landers, which makes a lot of sense because three legs, no matter what the terrain, you're going to get 3 points to land and touch down. And so all of the new landers that are being designed by other countries are three-legged landers. You go, well, that makes sense because you're coming down on the moon or, say, Mars or wherever you're landing, or even the Earth, you're coming down. And having four legs, like let's take an average table. You go to the store, buy a table, furniture store, whatever, you buy a table. You put it on the floor. And if you have a perfectly flat floor, then chances are if they built the table correctly, it would sit correctly on all four legs. If the table's a little bit flexible, then it could it could move a little bit to get all four legs touching the ground. But on a rigid table, if you don't have a perfectly flat floor with a perfectly designed table, you're going to have a little rock in it. You're going to have to stick a piece of paper or something, or some kind of wedge or something under that leg to keep it from going back and forth. Or same way with chairs. If you have a bunch of chairs in an uneven floor, you're going to have some of those chairs that are going to be rocking back and forth if the chairs are properly designed. So this brings us to the topic. What is the probability that if you sent 11 landers to the moon with four legs, now this is the Apollo program, that you would be able to find terrain? Because they're coming in, from the sky. They're coming in and landing, and they're, like, okay, let's land over there. And supposedly the guy is guiding it and bringing it down. What is the probability that all 11 of those places would, how many ever, would have perfectly flat area where all four legs would land and set perfectly and not rock back and forth? Well, it's pretty much zero, because the lunar surface, as portrayed, is very undulating. Let's put it in hilly and let's say undulations, which are very short range. Let's say the wavelength is very short. And so what's the probability that even one of these spacecraft in the Apollo program would come down and land with all 4 feet touching the ground? That'd be the table problem, where you're going to have one of these, those feet are going to be a little bit off. So this thing is going to rock back and forth, which would, okay, you can live with that if you're an astronaut. You would think that NASA, with all its preparedness and forethought and everything else, would have figured this out, how the astronauts would deal with this situation. But it's not the case. They all come down and all four legs perfectly on the terrain of the alleged lunar surface where they allegedly landed. So what's the probability that with a four-legged lander within a square, that all four of those legs would touch the lunar surface equally and perfectly? Well, the probability is like zero on an undulating surface. I mean, you would, and that's why they're designing new spacecraft with three legs, because you can come down with three legs and you could stand any place. You could land and be kind of sideways or kittywampus or over here. And by the way, back in the day, that was one of my things that I discovered also, is that when you land on the moon, okay, you're coming out of this orbit. There's an orbit around the moon, and the relay station, the orbiter, the lunar orbiter, where there's one guy supposedly waiting. The two guys go down and land. They do their stink, their stuff. Excuse me, stink. I don't know, that just popped out, a Freudian slip. They do their stuff on the lunar surface, and then they have to, like, rocket off the lunar surface and come back up and get into orbit with this other guy. And okay, so in a perfect world, you would come down and you would land in that orbital plane on the lunar surface. But if the lunar lander is kittywampus, just a hair, I mean, we're talking 0.001 degree off, when that baby comes back up into orbit, because it's got a single retro rocket that it launches with, as we see the movies of this, that's going up and, you know, up into space, the probability of that thing coming up into the same orbit is about zero. It's the same problem with the four-legged spacecraft landing on the lunar surface and having all four legs down. How do you get this thing now? Now you only have 2 points in that orbit where the original lunar orbiter orbit and the lunar lander coming up off the lunar surface, there's only 2 points in that orbit where they even come close to being together. And there's no way to correct this. Changing orbits is not an easy thing to do. Changing orbital the radius of the orbit, that's pretty easy. You just fire a rocket. But getting it back in perfectly into the orbit with the other one is really, really difficult to do. Okay, so anyway, that was an issue. But then there's this new issue of the four-legged spacecraft landing perfectly on the moon every time. And so it's just one more straw on the camel's back here. And as I say in my webpage, my official statement about my webpage is that the Apollo lunar landing is the unverified scientific claim. There's no third-party independent verification. And that's my official statement, which is valid. There's no independent third-party verification of the Apollo lunar landing. Okay, so enough of that. But, yeah, see me on Rents tonight. I'll be talking mainly about the 5G capacity issue and some other things going on. Excuse me. Here's something that came up. Matthew Perry, I think we all know him from the TV series Friends, which was, everybody have seen that. Even I watched some of them. And I think he was an actor. He was probably in a lot of other, maybe major movies. I don't really know his career, but he, all of a sudden one day he's hanging out, he's doing fine. The next day he's dead. And so they start listing all of these actors who are just like dropping over, you know, in their prime, really like 50s, they should be doing just great. And I think, you know, and of course, when you see the news, nobody talks about the old COVID shot there, but all of these actors ran right out and got it. Anyway, of course, nobody talks about that in the news. Here's an interesting topic. The James Webb Telescope was taking a look at Jupiter in the infrared. Now, this telescope is amazing. It's doing some amazing discoveries. And what they discovered was that there was a high-level belt of electrons rotating around Jupiter. And the way they see this is the heat signature that this creates, this current sheet. So if there's a heat signature, that means energy is being dissipated, just like if you took a picture, you know, you take your iron that you iron clothes with, you look at it in a normal room, it doesn't look, it's not giving off light to you, it's certainly not visible light, and it's, unless you have it so red hot that it's visibly red hot, you know, but even there you'd have to have it in a dark room to see that. But your typical iron is at a temperature where you're not going to see visible light coming off of it. But there is infrared light, which is what we call heat light. It's another term for it. So the James Webb Telescope is able to see heat dissipation from the electron current that's going around the equatorial belt of Jupiter. It's relatively narrow, which tells us also that it's pinched. It's a pinch current, so it's a fairly significant current. It's only a couple thousand miles wide. And for a plasma current in outer space, which basically this is, it's a it's a so high in the clouds of Jupiter that it's really in outer space. And I've been talking about this for a long time as one of the essential characteristics of the magnetic field. Now, Earth has one also. Earth has a magnetic field. It's coupled with plasma magnetic fields. And the equatorial stream goes westerly, and that's the same case with this jet stream on Jupiter. And they will be discovering more. But the fact that there's dissipation going on, in other words, heat creation, when they see the infrared signal, what I'm saying is like when you have your iron on, you plug it into the wall, you're ironing your clothes, it gets hot. And if you were to look at that with an infrared telescope or infrared, say, night vision or something like that, you would see the iron glowing in the infrared. And so that means that heat is from the electricity that you got plugged into the wall is being dissipated in the iron. So that's the same case that the James Webb telescope is seeing around Jupiter. So the fact that there's heat dissipation going on means that there has to be energy being driven into that electron current on a constant basis, or it would go away over a period of time. It would just, electric currents don't simply self-sustain out of nothing. They need energy sources, and the fact that there's dissipation going on means that some of that energy is bleeding off slowly. So energy has to be put into that system. And where does that come from? Well, ultimately, there's two sources. Jupiter has its own proton wind, which was measured by Voyager spacecraft. It was actually measured. And it was published literally in Science Magazine back in the early days. That's before NASA knew enough to filter its information going out to the public, because, of course, I was at Cornell at the time when this data is coming in, and I pointed that out, that this is an indication that Jupiter has fusion going on in its atmosphere. And so fusion indicating that Jupiter is a small star, not a planet, not an inert planet like Earth or Mars, or it is literally a small star. So it's the brown dwarf companion to the sun. And then, of course, since all kinds of infrared signatures, including the red spot, have been taken, pictures showing that Jupiter is, in fact, a small star. So very interesting. Okay. So getting back to Earth in comparison, now Jupiter has this great red spot. And back when Galileo first discovered it, and then scientists looked at telescopes, this thing is going around, and that's one of the indicators of the rotational period of Jupiter, that it's a round planet, it's going around, it's spinning on its axis. And so this great red spot is going around, and they thought it was like some kind of fixture or feature on the surface of Jupiter, thinking Jupiter was this planet. But then you get up close and personal, and it's a cyclonic storm. Well, it just keeps going around and around and around, not only that one, but lots of other storms at various different layers. Saturn had the same thing. And so the situation on Earth, when we have cyclonic storms like that, which here we call hurricanes, that develop over water, not so much over land because they short out to land, but on Jupiter, there is no land underneath to short it out. So it just keeps going and going and going like the Ever-Ready Bunny. And it is electrically powered. You can actually see that. And you can see what are known as whistlers in the industry. These are lightning bolts that cause this high-pitched electromagnetic frequency, and as a result of lightning. And so you can see them on Venus, you can see them on Jupiter, you can see them on Saturn. You can see them, I believe they've seen them on Titan, the moon of Saturn, the great big moon. And that has an atmosphere, but this is indicative of a an electric field. And so where does that come from? Well, there's two power sources. One is Jupiter's own plasma capacitor, which is caused by its own proton wind, excess current of protons in its fusion-based wind, and that of the Sun, because Jupiter, besides being its own source of energy, is discharging the solar capacitor. And so it has a relatively complicated electromagnetic structure around it, including what they call a magnetic tail, which is not a magnetic tail. It's part of the electrical discharge of the solar capacitor. And, of course, it produces a magnetic field. And, of course, that's one of the major downfalls of anything NASA does, is they think these magnetic fields out there just exist. They just like, oh, there's a magnetic field. And magnetic fields just don't simply exist in a plasma environment. They are a result of electrical currents. And so there's an electrical current, there's power dissipation, and something has to keep powering that electrical current. So anyway, that's the story here. But very interesting that finally scientists have discovered what I've been talking about all along, and that is the westward moving electron belt. And why is it westward moving? Because that is the direction that couples it to Jupiter's magnetic field, which has the pole, the magnetic pole, to the north. And just like Earth, the Earth's north pole, Jupiter and Earth spin in the same directions, and so the magnetic poles are in the same direction, and so an electron current would have to move westerly to couple to that magnetic field. An ion current, a positive ion current, would move easterly to couple to the same magnetic field. And that's like in the case on Earth. We have the equatorial electron stream that moves westerly. This is the upper level jet streams up in the ionosphere, literally. And then Earth has two belts of ion moving easterly, one in the northern hemisphere, one in the southern hemisphere. And then we have the equatorial belts, which once again are electrons moving in the westerly direction. That's what they call the ring currents. So Earth has five such belts. Jupiter has 13. And you notice that they also are odd numbers. And that's because the middle belt is surrounded symmetrically to the north and the south. And so the middle belt is an individual belt, and then you have corresponding belts to the north and south. So there's always an even number of those, which always gives you an odd number. So Jupiter has 13 belts, 12 plus 1, and Earth has 5 belts, 4 plus 1, the one being the equatorial, westerly equatorial band. So, and of course, this is so interesting that you're listening to this radio show. I pay for my own airtime, and, you know, because good people like you are buying, say, products from my books, etc., from the webpage, and that supports the webpage and other, you know, other expenses that I have, and a lot of times it doesn't cover my expenses. But that's fine, because the life in the big city. But you're hearing about these scientific details on a radio show that I'm an independent scientist. I don't have any government support. I don't work for any government agencies. And if you listen day and night, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, to all the radio stations out there that are weather channels or science base or whatever it is, the Discovery Channel, History Channel, what they propound to give out science, you won't ever hear this, because standard science just doesn't know about it. They're just ignorant. They're still going on theories from decades ago. But also, I wanted to talk, I mentioned the three-legged landers that they're developing. And so along with that, we have Japan and China and other nations that are developing space programs. They're intent on going to the moon and other places to do discovery work. So they both have manned, and I talked about this a little bit last week, about the advancements of the Chinese space program. The Japanese also, they are very diligently pursuing outer space. And the United States really is not. You have Musk, who is kind of off on his own program to go to Mars. And plus he's doing a lot of launching. His launch business is going just amazing, because he's, if you're in the United States and you have anything to launch, then Elon Musk is doing it. SpaceX. I mean, he's got a lot of things going on. I saw an interview with him asking him if he's dependent on rocket technology from Russia, because the Russian technologies, is they're going to start to block that from being used in the West and selling rocket parts, etc. Interestingly enough, the major aerospace corporations are the major aerospace corporations are buying parts from Russia for their rocket engines, but Musk is not. I mean, he originally ordered wholesale rocket engines from Russia, and then I imagine they reversed engineered them to the point where Musk is building his own rockets completely now. He's, you know, and that makes sense. I mean, from a business point of view, that makes sense. But he has the capability and the engineering capability to put that kind of staff towards building all of his own infrastructure, manufacturing capability, where he's building his own engines. And of course, the engines are the heart of any rocket. If you don't have good engines, you don't have rockets, period. Okay, on to a different topic here. This is a note from a listener, and I may have covered this before, but just briefly, a lot of times I talk about tsunamis that are a result of planets-sized comet nuclei coming by, and of course anything in the solar system that is that big is going to be in the form of a comet, because it's discharging the solar capacitor. But anyway, there are many effects, electrical, magnetic, but the gravitational ones are the ones that cause the earthquakes and the mountain building and the tsunamis. And so if this thing comes by far enough away, and now I'm not talking about anything specific, and I'm not saying that anything is coming, so don't misquote me on that. People have tried to actually take clips of what I'm talking about, put it together, and make it sound like the end of the world is going on. And so anyway, the suggestion was that when we're talking about the tsunamis, we think of a tsunami as kind of like you see a YouTube video of a tsunami, you know, and it's a wave coming in, and, you know, of course does damage locally, and like the one in India went in 100 miles, you know, but it's pretty much flat there where that wave came in, the one from Sumatra, and, you know, what, 10 years ago or more. And that's what we think of in terms of tsunamis. So this listener's suggestion was that when you talk about the big ones that are caused, you know, where you have, you know, enormous waves, enormous amounts of gravitational interaction that caused these, you know, more than mega tsunamis, that there should be a different name. Some new terminology needs to be given to these. And so what he was suggesting was super tidal event. And now that I like that, because it gets away from tsunami. Tsunami is kind of like, okay, it's like you've fallen down and scrape your knee when you're you know, a kid. Okay, that's different than having a great big cut in your knee or something. That's a different term. That would be called a gash or something, not a scratch. So terminology indicates the magnitude of what we're talking about. Okay, so a scratch is different than a gash, and then if something were bigger, it would be, you know, medical term, major intrusion or something like that. But so there has to be a different term for these planetary scale events in terms of water being gravitationally pushed. And like we hear the story of the parting of the Red Sea and Moses crossing with the people, and that was going on during the Venus event, and clearly that was a tsunami type of event where the water parted, and I mean they were able to walk across. We pretty much know where that was. There's a narrow channel where it's relatively shallow, and when the waters washed away, this was happening in the middle of the night as Venus is coming by, they cross this area with Pharaoh's army behind him, and there's the electrical discharge coming down that Moses, the Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston, it's an old movie. Very good description of those events and of the plagues and things like that. Other plagues caused by the electrical conditions of the comet, like the plague of Lotus and insects, etc., and frogs coming out of the ground. When we were kids, if we wanted to go fishing and we wanted to get worms, we'd go get the battery out of the car, put it there. We'd take two wires, and one on the plus cable, one on the other, being very careful not to short them together, of course. And then we'd put two like grounding rods into the ground, and then we'd clamp the wires from the plus and minus terminal on those rods going down in the ground. And before you knew it, all the worms and everything that was in the ground, bugs, everything, were coming out, and you picked what you wanted to use for bait. But that was because the electrical currents, for some reason, made it very uncomfortable for these things to be in the ground, and they all came out. Rather than digging a hole and trying to find worms, that's how we got our worms to go fishing. And so the same thing would go on with the Venus event, causing the plague, the vermin to come out of the ground, etc. And all of this very explainable by the conditions that happen when a comet comes by, not the least of which is the pillar of fire raising up, this tornado pillar of fire reaching up into the heavens. That's what the electrical discharge would look like. And then the parting of the sea would be in the sense of tsunami. So Venus was close enough. It was doing major damage. It caused a pole shift of about 30 degrees. So it was close. This thing, this Venus, the comet, was close. And the Earth had many events of this where it came closer and closer and closer over time, till finally it really came close. The Mayans talk about it, the Peruvians talk about it, the Incas, it carries over into the terminology of the Aztecs who came later. So anyway, the end result here is that there should be a different name for these planetary events. So super tidal event, I'll go with that. I like that. That was the listener's suggestion. Super tidal event, and that also covers the land tides, which are caused by the ones that cause mountain building, where you're talking about and people say, well, how fast is this wave moving? If we talk about, say, the moon coming, the Earth is spinning under the moon. By the way, it's not so much the movement. It's not only the movement of this object by Earth. But Earth is spinning on its axis, and the velocity at the equator is 1,000 miles an hour. So the tidal wave of Earth, just the regular tides, the ocean tides, are moving at a rate of about 1,000 miles an hour at the equator, and a little bit less as you go to northern or southern hemisphere latitudes. But I mean, that's really moving. That's faster than a jet plane. Okay, so anyway, the new term, I'm going to put this in my notes for future, super tidal event. Maybe I'll do a little thought on that, because it's a lot of times when you use the term super or ultra, this happens like in the electronics industry or in, say, cameras. they go high definition. Well, what does that mean? 10 years ago, high definition was different than high definition today. So saying ultra high definition, okay, well, same thing. That's a relative term. If you wait 2 or 3 years, ultra high definition changes. What's ultra high today is not the same as yesterday. So when you use terms like that, superlative terms, super tidal event, it's relative to the in the you know the you could say a super tidal event, or is it a that's why they have things like the Richter scale, where you have a earthquake, and it's such and such on the Richter scale. And by the way, people have asked me what a Richter scale reading would be for one of these planetary objects coming by, mountain building. And given that the Richter scale is logarithmic, for every one digit that you go up, from a 7 to an 8 or an 8 to a 9, that's a factor of 10. So if you go up 2 points, like from 6 to 8, that's 100 times as much energy, etc. And of course, it's a really strange thing to try and determine, because earthquakes, did it last a long time? Was there a lot of damage? Was it like a just a little shake? Like a 2 second shake and that's it? Or, so the Richter scale does not really cover all the bases. It's kind of an easy buzzword to use for the public. And once you peel back the first layer, it's really not very descriptive at all. But it's better than the super tsunami or super earthquake or ultra super earthquake or superlative terms like that. It's not as good. So, at any rate, so anyway, I'm putting that on my table, but I think I'll not use the term super tidal event, and then maybe create a scale of, because this would be above the Richter scale. And getting back to the idea of the Richter scale, it might be on this, a really intense big earthquake on Earth might be an 8 or a 9. A really big one would be 9. This would be like maybe 20 or 25 on the Richter scale, something you can't even imagine. Remember, Christ was talking about when in the they asked him about the end days. He said, not a stone will be left on a stone. And that means some pretty earth rocking, and he knew about the Egyptian pyramids that was designed to withstand earthquakes. A lot of the structures of the Peruvians were designed so that when they're shaking, they would fall in towards each other. They would slide in and not come apart, because just average walls that were built to for average gravity are not built to fall in or cascade in on themselves. Whereas a lot of the Peruvian walls were built with the idea, if there's any shaking going on, serious shaking, they will move together. They will actually slide together a little bit, because the idea is that they will move, they will be juxtapositioned a little bit, and they would fall together. So anyway, okay. So enough of that. I wanted to get back to the Jupiter winds, something I've been talking about for a long time now. And this year we've had really a long period. Up until a couple of days ago, I've been watching world wind patterns. They're still going on. So we're still connected with Jupiter, and right now is the pretty much the direct lineal alignment with Jupiter. So they started probably a good month ago, indicating that the connection with Jupiter happened early, and I can't really figure out why that is, other than these electrical currents change locations. And there's other things going on. There's the galactic wind that's being buffered out there. There are things that we simply don't know about. There are factors that we might imagine, like the effect of the galactic wind, which is a wind of protons coming out from the galactic nucleus and out the galactic arm, and electrical currents that go back down the galactic arm. I talk about that in my space science astronomy course, and But anyway, back to the Jupiter winds, we are connecting electrically with the discharge of Jupiter, the discharge of the solar capacitor. Earth is doing the same thing, and when those electrical currents connect, we get a cross solar system electrical connection, which drives our weather systems, and that's what causes the Jupiter winds. And if I had a college lecture hall, if I was back at Cornell, I would be this would be a many, many, many lecture series in a advanced graduate level astrophysics course. But to the public, as I have to keep them things relatively simplified so that I don't lose listeners. I mean, if I went on a long diatribe about the all of the different aspects of these electrical connections, then I would lose a lot of audience. Let's just put it that way. But the world has been experiencing these, and once again, what you will see are straight line winds, and they might occur for 24 hours, 10, 12 hours, 24 hours, maybe a number of days. And they might be anywhere from 20 miles an hour to 50 miles an hour. And there's gusting in the sense of, some changing wind speed, but they're pretty much straight line winds. And they're just there. They're just going like, what the heck's going on? These winds are just howling out there. And then you wake up the next morning, they're still there. You go to bed that night, they're still there. And, 2, 3 days, then they calm down and they come back. And those are the Jupiter winds. Every 13 months, Earth connects with this electrical discharge of Jupiter, and we get the Jupiter winds. And it could cause, for example, this Hurricane Otis off the west coast of California that hit Acapulco. I think it was named Otis. Pacific Hurricane came up and went back east. Tremendous amount of damage there. I have not seen all the reports, but clearly a Category 5 hurricane is going to break windows. It's going to, especially that big wall of hotels in Acapulco, just trying to withstand against that wind. There's going to be just a lot of window breakage, and then the water comes pouring in, and a lot of water damage and wind damage. I mean, there's probably whole hotels that have had huge amounts of damage that'll be a while till they can actually reopen, get the building materials in there. In a place like Acapulco, it's not easy to get building materials in there. They would have to come in by ship, and then you have infrastructure, just a real mess. But there again, very easy to correlate that with the Jupiter winds situation. Just like anything, normally Otis would have been a Category 2, dying out wouldn't have caused much problem. Maybe dumped a lot of rain there, which they're used to. The Acapulco is on the Pacific coast, so they're used to rainy season and rain. But a Category 5, full-blown Cat 5 hurricane, wow, it's enough to knock your socks off, as they say. But and so if you're say or in the Western Hemisphere someplace, probably the majority of my listening audience, or Europe or Africa, wherever you are, that's the thing. You're going to experience these every place. It's not like it's going to be individualized to one small location. It's going to be everywhere. The same situation, like I say, a couple days, maybe might be 10 or 12 hours. But it's usually a number of days, and once these winds get going, they just keep going, like the ever-ready bunny, the Jupiter winds. Okay, so I think I've covered most of my topics tonight. Just want to remind you, check out my water filters, jmccwaterfilters.com, and if you have the gravity replacement or the gravity water filter, that's the stainless steel tanks, one on top of the other one. My replacement water filter elements are the best in the industry. And then also the MR5, which I recommend. I recommend that people stop using gravity water filters in general. If you can't afford a whole house water filter, then look at it this way. Over the years, you will spend as much money on gravity water filters as you will on a whole house water filter. So if you can manage at the time, get the whole house water filter, which is the MR5. The best steel is very, very good price. What you get, stainless steel construction, and very high quality product. So if you can manage that, get the whole house water filter. The best deal, what we call the best deal on the web page, is the MR5 whole house water filter, the ultraviolet sterilizer, and the extra pack of filter elements, which then you have two sets of filter elements for the MR5, and that is for a very, very good price. This week I talked to some people who were looking at water softeners, and that was their original call, was how about should we get a water softener? And I said, well, first of all, I don't have anything to do with water softeners. It's really a kind of an insane business out there. People charging huge amounts of money for a water softener. But if you have that calcium buildup, it's on the toilet and around the shower, the glass is full of, then maybe you need a water softener. It's a personal choice, but don't let somebody charge you some huge amount of money for a water softener, and then get the whole house water filter, my MR5, and have just go to a big box store, buy a water softener. It's just a tank with salt in it, nothing really specific, and then have the plumber install all of this at one time. That was my recommendation. So once again, the webpage jmccwaterfilters.com, and go to the top where it says shop products, and then all the products are listed there. Also, my webpage jmccsci.com, you have access to my books, my book library. J. McCanney Science is the webpage, but the short URL jmccsci.com. You can also get to the water filter page from there. And also my latest book, The Real History of Man and Earth, Myth, Magic, and Mayhem, is available on Amazon, and people are buying that there. So once again, thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.